On March 15, 2007, beneath the quiet veneer of suburban Villa Park, Illinois, a love triangle turned fatal. Rebecca Becky Klein, an Illinois State grad and devoted partner, vanished without a trace. 2 days later, investigators opened the trunk of her classic 1966 Mustang to find her, bound, blindfolded, suffocated. Her domestic partner, Nicole Abusharif, claimed innocence, but as shocking evidence unfolded, duct-taped limbs, fingerprints on the bag, false alibis, a secret romance, and a possible $400,000 insurance motive, the public watched in horror. Could passion and greed drive someone to murder the person they called their own? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Shadows on Harvard Avenue, Villa Park, Illinois, March 15, 2007. The neighborhood was the kind you wouldn't look twice at. Middle class, quiet. Just 20 miles west of downtown Chicago. Single-story ranch homes lined the block, faded shutters and trimmed hedges hinting at lives lived with some measure of routine. On Harvard Avenue, things didn't seem to change. People waved at each other. Garbage days came and went. And behind one such white ranch house sat a restored 1966 silver Mustang, a showpiece Nicole Abusharif had bought as a surprise for her longtime partner, Rebecca Becky Klein. The car sat gleaming in the driveway like a token of devotion. But beneath the polished chrome and the manicured lawn, something much darker was boiling. The life they built. Nicole Abusharif was 26. Petite, brown-eyed, and clever, she had a kind of charismatic, scrappy confidence that could win over a room. Becky Klein, at 32, was her opposite in many ways, softer-spoken, studious, a homebody. She worked in IT and loved her cats like children. They'd been together for about 7 years, building a life that, on the surface, seemed solid. Close friends, matching tattoos, even plans to adopt. They shared bills, groceries, a home. From the outside, it looked like two women who had weathered enough storms to stay strong. But in early 2007, those closest to them began to notice fractures. Friction and distance friends recalled, quietly, on the bag, on the tape, on the bandana. Nicole stared at the photos for several seconds, then whispered, that doesn't make sense. But the evidence said otherwise, a web of inconsistencies. Over the next several hours, Nicole's story began to change. First, she said Becky left on foot. Then she said maybe someone broke in. She claimed she hadn't touched the trunk, then admitted to checking the car, just to be sure. She couldn't explain how her DNA ended up on the inside of the garbage bag. She couldn't explain why she used Becky's debit card after Becky was already dead. And she couldn't explain the life insurance policy, the one that named Nicole as the sole beneficiary, worth nearly $400,000. Investigators now had motive, opportunity, and physical evidence, but the deeper they dug, the stranger Nicole's double life became. The Rose Sodaro tapes. When detectives sat down with Rose Sodaro, it became clear just how far Nicole had gone. Rose was emotional. She'd only recently learned that Nicole wasn't dying of brain cancer, that she wasn't a firefighter, that she wasn't even single. Everything she'd believed about the woman she loved was a lie. She said she was trapped, Rose told them, that she was being hurt by someone she couldn't get away from. She made it sound like she was in danger. Rose also shared something chilling. Just days before Becky's death, Nicole had asked her, if you really love someone, would you do anything for them? Detectives asked what she meant. Rose said she didn't know at the time. But now, looking back, it felt like a test. Nicole had tried to lure Rose into being an unknowing accomplice, or at least a compliant alibi. She failed. The insurance trail. The life insurance policy was signed in late 2006, barely a year before the murder. It had all the right boxes checked. Nicole listed as domestic partner, sole recipient. There was even a clause covering accidental death. Investigators tracked Nicole's financial history. She had no stable job. She lived largely off Becky's income. Credit cards were maxed out. She owed thousands. Her car had been repossessed. But this policy, it was her escape hatch. If Becky died under the right conditions, Nicole would collect enough money to walk away from every mistake she'd made. She could vanish, reinvent herself, maybe even build a new life with Rose. This wasn't just a crime of passion, it was premeditated financial homicide, building the case. By the end of March, the case file was growing by the hour, duct tape and bag match supplies in the house. Nicole's fingerprints were found on multiple items directly involved in Becky's death. DNA evidence placed Nicole at the scene at the time of death. Cell phone data contradicted her alibi. Nicole texted Becky's phone after her death, pretending to look for her. She made withdrawals from Becky's bank account within hours of the murder. And then came the clincher. Nicole searched online for suffocation techniques. All this, on top of her tangled lies to Rose, her bizarre behavior after the murder, and the coldness with which she slipped back into daily life. Prosecutors had more than enough to file formal charges. Arrest and charges. On March 21, 2007, just 6 days after Becky's body was found, Nicole Abu Sharif was arrested for first-degree murder. The public response was explosive. News outlets immediately latched onto the term lesbian love triangle murder. Headlines focused on the sensational aspects, the online affair, the staged cancer story, the life insurance motive. But beneath the tabloid buzz was a brutal personal betrayal. Becky's family issued a brief statement. We lost a daughter, a sister, a friend. What happened to Becky wasn't about headlines. It was about trust being shattered in the most devastating way. Nicole, during her arraignment, pled not guilty. Her defense team hinted they would challenge everything, from the DNA to the motive, but behind the scenes, even they were alarmed by the scope of her lies. Prison phone calls. While awaiting trial in the DuPage County Jail, Nicole made several recorded phone calls, to friends, to former lovers, and even to her parents. In one, she laughed about how insane people thought she was. In another, she asked someone to delete her MySpace account, and in yet another, she said something investigators would never forget. If I had just kept my mouth shut, they never would have found her. It wasn't a confession, but it was enough. Every word tightened the prosecution's grip. The trial was set for early 2009, and Nicole, still clinging to the version of herself she created, brave, misunderstood, and dying, would finally face the truth she could no longer bury. Chapter 5. Forensic Avalanche. DuPage County, Illinois. Early 2009. By the time the trial of Nicole Abu Sharif began, the case had become one of the most scrutinized murder investigations in recent Illinois memory. Prosecutors had spent 2 years building what they called a bulletproof case, a web of forensics, timelines, digital data, and psychological manipulation that pointed squarely at one woman. But it wasn't just the evidence that shocked people. It was the cold efficiency behind it, a crime without rage, a betrayal without emotion, and a killer who still insisted she was innocent. What came next was the forensic avalanche. The crime scene reconstructed prosecutors opened the trial with a meticulous timeline. They recreated the evening of March 15, 2007, from the moment Becky Klein returned home to the moment her body was placed in the trunk. Using digital forensics, they showed that Nicole's phone had been active in the house during the suspected time of death. Call records proved she had not left, as she previously claimed. They showed surveillance footage from Rose Sodaro's dorm, Nicole entering the building less than 2 hours after Becky was believed to have been murdered. The implication, Nicole had committed the murder, cleaned up, and gone to spend the night with the teenage girl she was grooming. But it was the physical evidence that hit hardest. Fingerprints, tape, and truth crime scene techs walked the jury through the grim artifacts. Duct tape, wrapped around Becky's mouth and wrists, bore Nicole's thumbprint. A plastic garbage bag placed over Becky's head had Nicole's palm print on the inside of the bag, an indication that she had placed it directly over her partner's face. The bandana blindfold contained skin cells matching Nicole's DNA. Defense attorneys suggested the items could have been touched at an earlier time, possibly during normal household use, but the prosecution responded with clarity. None of these items had any reason to be on Becky's body unless someone had put them there intentionally. They also introduced trace evidence. Fibers from a blanket in the couple's shared bedroom were found on Becky's clothes. That same blanket had been washed after the murder, but never dried. An attempt, the prosecution argued, to eliminate scent or blood. There was no blood, no struggle, just silence, which only deepened the horror. The Mustang and the Motionless. The restored 1966 Mustang wasn't just a car. It became the murder scene, the evidence locker, and the casket. Crime scene photos showed Becky's body placed gently inside, curled into a fetal position. She had not been tossed in, but arranged, carefully, almost methodically. Prosecutors said that choice mattered. This was someone trying to erase the evidence, the lead attorney said. Not someone panicking, not someone reacting, someone in control. Nicole had claimed she never opened the trunk, but her DNA was found on the latch, and more importantly, on the inside of the trunk lid, indicating she had leaned inside to place or adjust the body. She didn't just kill Becky. She tucked her away like a secret. Digital clues. The prosecution then introduced a digital forensics expert who laid out Nicole's online activity leading up to the murder. One search stood out. How to make someone pass out without leaving marks. Another, sleeping pills and suffocation. Nicole's laptop also showed visits to a life insurance calculator, as well as recent email correspondence with Becky's provider confirming her policy was active, and Nicole was listed as the sole beneficiary. And perhaps most disturbing, a draft email Nicole had written but never sent to Rose. In it she wrote, "Soon it'll just be us. No more lies. No more past. I promise." It was time-stamped 2 hours before Becky's estimated time of death. For the jury, that wasn't just circumstantial. It was chillingly intentional. The defense strategy Nicole's legal team tried to plant doubt. They argued the case was being sensationalized because of the relationship's same-sex dynamic. They claimed the media frenzy had influenced the investigation and that Nicole was being villainized for her lifestyle, not her actions. They painted Nicole as emotionally unstable, but not a killer. She lied, the defense attorney admitted. She lied about cancer, about being a firefighter, about a lot of things. But lying doesn't make you a murderer. They proposed an alternate theory that someone else, possibly an unknown third party, could have entered the home and staged the scene. They hinted that Becky had previously been emotionally distraught and could have invited danger. But they had no evidence, and the prosecution had more than enough. Character on trial. Several of Nicole's former friends were called to testify. Many admitted they had stopped speaking to her before the murder due to her increasingly bizarre behavior. One recalled how Nicole told her she was in danger from someone in her own house. Another testified that Nicole had once asked her, "If something happened to Becky, would you think I did it?" The courtroom fell silent. Then came Rose Sodaro. Now 21, she took the stand with a quiet but steady voice. She recounted her entire relationship with Nicole. The cancer lie, the firefighter story, the talk of moving in together, and the night Nicole showed up at her dorm just hours after the murder. She seemed relieved, Rose said, like a weight was off. When the prosecution asked if Nicole ever talked about Becky in those hours, Rose shook her head. "No," she said. "It was like Becky didn't exist anymore." Expert witnesses. A medical examiner explained the cause of death, asphyxiation by plastic bag and duct tape. There were no bruises, no scratches, and no defensive wounds, all of which suggested Becky had not struggled. She may have trusted Nicole or been drugged, though toxicology results were inconclusive. A behavioral profiler from the FBI gave insight into the mindset. "This was not a spontaneous act," he said. "It was a calculated decision. The goal wasn't rage or revenge. It was elimination. Clean, quiet, and beneficial to the suspect. The benefit? Freedom. A fresh start, and $400,000. The weight of evidence." By the end of the prosecution's presentation, the jury had heard over 24 witnesses, seen hundreds of photos, and been walked through timeline reconstructions, financial records, text messages, and expert analysis. The evidence didn't just point to Nicole. It circled her, boxed her in, and buried every excuse. She declined to testify in her own defense. And when closing arguments began, the prosecution said simply, she wanted a new life, so she destroyed the one she had. Chapter 6. Trial of Secrets. DuPage, County Courthouse. Spring 2009. It had been over 2 years since Rebecca Klein was found lifeless in the trunk of her silver Mustang. The media frenzy surrounding her murder had not subsided. If anything, it intensified as the trial of Nicole Abu-Sharif began. Outside the courtroom, satellite vans and reporters lined the curb. Inside, an unsettling quiet filled the room as 12 jurors prepared to confront a case of love, lies, and cold-blooded betrayal. But this wouldn't just be about what Nicole did. It would be about who she was and what she was capable of hiding behind a smile. The courtroom stage. Nicole entered the courtroom wearing a beige blouse and black slacks. Her hair was pulled back neatly. Gone was the bravado of her MySpace posts. Gone was the smirk from early interviews. What sat before the jury was a woman composed, but unreadable. Becky Klein's family filled the front row. Her sister clutched a framed photo throughout opening statements. Her mother refused to look at Nicole. The lead prosecutor began with a simple sentence. This was a murder born of manipulation and greed. And then, piece by piece, they began to unravel Nicole's carefully crafted world. The state's opening strategy. The prosecution built the foundation on four key pillars. Motive. The $400,000 life insurance policy taken out less than a year before Becky's death. Opportunity. Nicole was alone with Becky in the home that night. Means, duct tape, plastic bag, and bindings, all traced back to Nicole. Behavior. Her lies, her alibis, and her affair with Rose Sodaro. They told the jury this wasn't a crime of passion, it was a decision. Nicole wanted out. Out of a long-term relationship, out of financial strain, and into a fantasy life with someone new. And to get that, she needed Becky gone. The defense's opening tactic. Nicole's attorneys offered a vastly different picture. They portrayed Nicole as troubled, but not violent. A woman who had lied out of fear, out of shame, out of confusion, but not guilt. They claimed the case against her was built on speculation, that she was being judged for her sexual orientation, her lifestyle, her eccentricity, not for any actual evidence. She was living a double life, yes, the defense admitted. But that double life did not make her a murderer. They suggested a break-in, an unknown intruder, a tragic coincidence, anything but premeditated murder. But over the next 2 weeks, the prosecution would close every door they opened. Rose Sodaro's testimony. The courtroom was hushed when Rose Sodaro, now 21, took the stand. She looked down often, voice shaking as she recalled her relationship with Nicole. She described how Nicole claimed to be a firefighter with terminal cancer, how they met on MySpace, and how quickly things escalated. She said she had 6 months to live, Rose told the jury. I believed her. She recounted the night of the murder, how Nicole had shown up at her dorm with clothes and a CD, how she seemed unusually calm, and how Nicole had texted Becky's phone while lying beside Rose in bed. She told me she was finally free, Rose said. I didn't understand what that meant at the time. Now she did. When the prosecutor asked, did Nicole ever mention hurting Becky? Rose said no. But she talked about starting over, a new life, and Becky wasn't part of that picture. The evidence mounts. The state called 27 witnesses in total, each one reinforcing a piece of the puzzle. The forensics expert who confirmed Nicole's fingerprints were on the duct tape and bag. The digital analyst who found Nicole's internet searches on suffocation techniques. The financial officer who testified about the life insurance payout Nicole stood to receive. The pathologist who stated Becky died from slow suffocation, likely conscious during at least part of the ordeal. Jurors were shown the garage, the trunk, the fibers, the fingerprint swirls. Every detail was laid bare. A neighbor testified that she saw Nicole moving something large into the garage on the night of March 15th. It looked like a rolled-up rug, she said. But I can't be sure. The implication was chilling enough. Nicole's silence. Nicole did not testify. Her attorneys argued that the evidence had been misinterpreted, that Nicole had panicked after finding Becky dead, that she had placed her in the trunk out of fear, afraid no one would believe the truth. But they had no theory on how Becky died, no alternate suspect, no confession, just the absence of answers. And the jury noticed. Closing arguments. The prosecution's closing argument was direct. Nicole Abusharif wanted to escape her life, but instead of facing that reality, she killed the person who loved her most. She didn't snap. She planned. She packed duct tape. She blindfolded Becky. She placed a bag over her head. She closed the trunk. And then she went to her new girlfriend's dorm like nothing had happened. They paused, then added, "She thought we'd never find the body. But we did. And now you've found the truth." The defense countered with emotion. They pleaded for the jury to see Nicole as a person. Flawed, confused, overwhelmed. This case is tragic, but it's not murder. 12 people would decide which version of reality to believe. The jury's task deliberations lasted just under 7 hours. When the foreperson stood to read the verdict, Nicole stared straight ahead. Becky's mother held her breath. "We, the jury, find the defendant, Nicole Abusharif, guilty of first-degree murder." There was no reaction from Nicole, no tears, no outburst, just silence. Becky's family wept quietly. Outside, reporters scrambled to relay the news, another twist in the headline story of a love triangle gone deadly. But for those who knew Becky, this wasn't about shock or scandal. It was about justice, and it had finally arrived. Chapter 7. Verdict and Echoes. DuPage County Courthouse, July 28, 2009. The courtroom was tense, but hushed, as Judge George Bacalis prepared to hand down the sentence. Nicole Abusharif, convicted of first-degree murder in the calculated killing of her domestic partner Rebecca Klein, stood motionless beside her attorneys. Her pale face betrayed little emotion. After a trial marked by betrayal, obsession, and forensic precision, the final act was about to unfold. Outside, reporters buzzed. Inside, a grieving family waited to see if justice would feel real, or just official. The sentence. Nicole was sentenced to 50 years in prison, the maximum allowed under Illinois law at the time, without a death penalty or life without parole. There would be no possibility of early release until 2057, when she would be 76 years old. Judge Bacalis was firm in his delivery. This was not a moment of rage. This was not a crime of impulse. It was methodical. It was cold. It was designed. You deprived another human being of her life so that you could start over without her. Nicole didn't speak. She didn't cry. She simply nodded once and was led away in handcuffs. Becky's family, seated in the front row, embraced. For them, justice had taken 28 months. But the wound would last a lifetime. The aftermath. The trial and conviction didn't end the public's fascination. If anything, it intensified it. Nicole's story was unlike anything most people had seen, a woman who created a fantasy persona, a firefighter dying of cancer, a 19-year-old lover she groomed on MySpace, a coldly executed murder of her longtime partner, a motive fueled by freedom, lust, and life insurance. Tabloids branded it the lesbian love triangle murder. News segments dissected every photo, every text message, every second of trial footage. Nicole became a symbol, not just of betrayal, but of how easily lies can metastasize into violence. But for those close to Becky, she wasn't a headline. She was a daughter, a sister, a cat mom, a quiet soul who loved horror movies and crossword puzzles and Thai food. She had plans. She was saving for a new couch. She wanted to travel to Ireland one day, and none of that would happen. Life behind bars. Nicole was transferred to Dwight Correctional Center, a maximum security prison for women in Illinois. There, she was given a cell, a number, and a strict daily routine. No more fantasy, no rose, no Mustang, no lies to hide behind. In prison, Nicole reportedly kept to herself. She worked in the kitchen. She refused interviews. Occasionally, she received letters. From strangers. From former friends. From people who wanted to understand how someone could do what she did. She didn't respond. In 2014, she filed a motion for appeal, claiming ineffective counsel and procedural issues. The court denied her request, stating the evidence was overwhelming and indisputable. Nicole remained behind bars. The unanswered questions. Even after the verdict, some questions lingered. Did Nicole act entirely alone? Did Becky ever suspect she was in danger? Could anyone have stopped it if they'd seen the signs earlier? Investigators insisted the case was airtight. No other suspect. No evidence of anyone else present. But what haunted Becky's loved ones most wasn't the crime. It was the intimacy of the betrayal. She wasn't killed by a stranger in the night. She was killed by the woman who shared her home, her life, and her trust. A woman who smiled and joked with her in the same week she suffocated her. A woman who once promised forever. Public reflection. In the years that followed, the case was featured on multiple documentaries, including segments on Dateline NBC, Snapped, and Forensic Files. Each time, the story was retold with clinical precision and psychological analysis. But for Becky's mother, one interview stood out. She looked into the camera and said, "We don't want her remembered as a victim. We want her remembered as someone who was loved, someone who deserved better." Becky's friends held annual gatherings in her honor, sharing memories, lighting candles, and playing her favorite music. One friend brought the crossword puzzle she'd never finished. Another brought photos from their last vacation. Each year someone new would say the same thing. She was just good. And she's gone because someone couldn't be honest. Legacy Nicole Abu Sharif remains incarcerated in Illinois. As of now, she will not be eligible for parole until her late 70s. Becky Cline's story continues to serve as a tragic reminder that emotional manipulation is not always visible, that abuse can be quiet, that danger can wear a familiar face, that love, when betrayed, can become the motive for something monstrous. In the end, it wasn't just about murder. It was about deception, control. And what happens when the person you trust the most is the one planning your end? That Becky seemed tired, not physically, but emotionally. Nicole was partying more, sometimes disappearing for days, giving vague explanations. Becky, they said, wanted stability. Nicole wanted something else. Attention. Thrill. A new kind of love. What Becky didn't know was that Nicole was living a double life. Online, she'd met a 19-year-old named Rose Sodaro on MySpace. Nicole told Rose she was a Chicago firefighter and had terminal cancer. She said she was single. Her lies were deep, manipulative, and strategic. Rose believed every word. They began an intense, fast-paced emotional affair. Within weeks, Nicole was spending nights at Rose's dorm in Lyons Township. She even brought flowers and talked about a future together. She promised they'd move in together after she handled some things at home. But Becky had no idea, or if she did, she said nothing. The morning of March 15th, it was a Thursday. Becky didn't show up for work. Her co-workers were immediately concerned. It wasn't like her to miss a day without calling. They tried her cell phone. No answer. After a few hours, one of them contacted Nicole. Nicole's response was odd. She told co-workers that Becky had gone out drinking the night before and hadn't come home. She seemed unconcerned, a little irritated even. But the car, the prized Mustang, was still in the driveway. Later that afternoon, Nicole drove to Rose's dorm in LaGrange. She had a bag of clothes, a CD case, and an alibi. "I've had a crazy night," she reportedly told Rose. "But I'm free now." Free from what? Suspicion sets in. When Villa Park police arrived at the couple's home on March 16th to conduct a welfare check, Nicole gave them a loosely constructed story. She said she hadn't seen Becky since the morning before, that maybe she'd gone to visit a friend. She offered vague timelines, couldn't recall phone numbers, and seemed detached. One officer noticed the Mustang. The hood was warm, though Nicole insisted it hadn't been driven. The officers didn't push hard, yet. Nicole let them look around the house. Nothing seemed overtly disturbed. No sign of a break-in, no blood, no struggle. But something wasn't right. The disappearance deepens. By March 17th, Becky's friends had reached a tipping point. She hadn't contacted anyone. Not family, not co-workers, not her closest friends. They insisted police take the case seriously. That same day, detectives decided to recheck the garage and the Mustang. It was locked. When they opened the trunk, the smell hit first. Then came the sight, Becky Klein's body, folded and bound inside. She was face down, duct tape across her limbs and mouth, and a cloth bandana around her head like a blindfold. She had been dead for at least 36 hours. Nicole's reaction. When police informed Nicole that Becky had been found in the trunk of her own car, she reportedly broke down, tears, shock. But within minutes, inconsistencies started piling up. For one, she told detectives she had gone out for pizza the night before Becky vanished, but her stories changed slightly with each retelling. Then there were the text messages. Nicole had been texting Becky's phone after her death, pretending to not know where she was. She even told one friend Becky might be off with some girl. The web of lies was just starting to unwind. A private life in public view. By the time Sunday rolled around, local news outlets had picked up the story. A young woman murdered and hidden in her own trunk. A long-term partner who couldn't give straight answers. An online affair with a teenager. And now, whispers of a $400,000 life insurance policy Nicole had taken out on Becky just months before. This was no random act of violence. It was a betrayal from within. Detectives subpoenaed phone records, digital logs, and surveillance footage. Nicole's phone pinged near the garage at times she claimed to be elsewhere. Becky's time of death lined up almost exactly with the window in which Nicole had no verifiable alibi. Still, Nicole wasn't arrested, yet. Investigators wanted more. Forensic evidence. Motive. A timeline tight enough to hold in court. What remained? The autopsy confirmed the cause of death. Suffocation. No signs of sexual assault. No defensive wounds. She was bound, silenced, and left to die in the very car Nicole had gifted her. A symbolic and literal tomb. Becky's family was devastated. They'd always had mixed feelings about Nicole, sensing something off. But never this. Never murder. At her funeral, her mother clutched a framed photo and sobbed. She never saw it coming. And maybe she didn't. Nicole continued to deny involvement. But detectives were now focused. This was no longer a missing person case. It was the beginning of a murder investigation. And Nicole Abusharif, manipulator, liar, lover, was at its center. Chapter 2. A Secret Flame. On the outside, Nicole Abusharif seemed like a committed partner. She and Becky Klein shared a home, pets, bills, and 7 years of memories. But behind the facade of domestic life, Nicole had built something else. An entire identity, fabricated and manicured for someone else, someone younger, someone easier to manipulate. Her name was Rose Sodaro. She was 19 years old, just barely out of high school, and entirely unaware she was about to be pulled into a murder case that would grip the nation. Digital seduction. They met where many secret affairs began in the mid-2000s, MySpace. Nicole, using the screen name Nicole1926, portrayed herself as a heroic figure. She told Rose she was a Chicago firefighter, a dangerous, demanding job that immediately evoked admiration. But she didn't stop there. She claimed she had been recently diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. Her time was limited, she said. She wanted to live fully, love deeply, and not waste another second. To Rose, it felt like fate. Nicole's lies were deliberate and dramatic. She told Rose she was single, never mentioning Becky Klein. She said she was ready to find love again before her illness took her. She sent poems, playlists, flirty messages laced with tragedy. She painted herself as a woman living on borrowed time, bold, romantic, and brave. And Rose believed her. A fast flame. The relationship progressed with alarming speed. Within 2 weeks of their online messages, Nicole was visiting Rose in person. She brought gifts. Clothes, DVDs, stuffed animals. She told her friends she was helping a friend in crisis, but in truth, she was seducing a teenager with carefully layered lies. Nicole began spending the night at Rose's Lagrange dormitory, sleeping in her bed, whispering promises. She wasn't terminally ill. She wasn't a firefighter. She wasn't single. But none of that mattered yet. The double life. During the day, Nicole kept up appearances with Becky. Cooking, cleaning, pretending. But by night, she slipped away to Rose's dorm, feeding two very different versions of herself. To Becky, she remained distant, but functional. To Rose, she was dying, a woman with nothing to lose, whose every second had to count. She was orchestrating a fantasy. She even asked Rose if she would consider moving in together once she got things settled. Nicole's manipulation wasn't random. It was calculated. Investigators would later uncover text messages and emails showing Nicole's obsessive desire to start a new life, with Rose and without Becky. And according to detectives, she was willing to kill for that freedom. The plan in motion. 2 weeks before Becky's death, Nicole ramped up her communication with Rose. Messages became more intense. She told her that she felt trapped, that her home life was unbearable, that she wanted out. She said she didn't want to die alone, Rose later told detectives. She said I made her feel alive again. Then, on March 15, 2007, the same day Becky was murdered, Nicole showed up at Rose's dorm wearing a red tank top, jean shorts, and a hoodie. She looked exhausted, but giddy. She brought Rose a CD case and some clothes. She was smiling. When Rose asked what happened, Nicole replied, "It's handled." "Handled how?" Red flags. During their time together that night, Nicole made several odd comments. She asked Rose what it would be like if they ran away together. She asked if Rose had ever kept a secret for someone they loved. And she asked, almost casually, "Have you ever known someone who just disappeared?" Rose thought it was strange, but she chalked it up to Nicole's grief or stress. The cancer story had created an emotional buffer that excused Nicole's every strange move. What Rose didn't know was that, just hours earlier, Nicole had killed Becky and stuffed her into the trunk of their car. And now she was asking Rose, unknowingly, to be her alibi. The lies unravel. By March 18th, the story was unraveling fast. Nicole's phone pinged at locations that contradicted her alibi. Forensic techs recovered fingerprints matching Nicole on the plastic bag and duct tape that had been used to bind Becky. More damning, Nicole had used Becky's debit card after her death. She claimed she didn't know Becky was dead yet. It didn't make sense. Nicole told police she had been with a friend on the night Becky disappeared, but refused to give Rose's name. When detectives traced the digital connection, they discovered the MySpace exchanges, the firefighter lie, the cancer lie, the messages that hinted at starting fresh, and then Rose came forward. Rose tells all. When detectives interviewed Rose, she was devastated. She had no idea Nicole had a long-term partner, no clue that Becky had been murdered, and certainly no inkling that Nicole had tried to build an entire new life on a foundation of deceit. "She told me she loved me," Rose said in her interview. "I thought I knew her." Rose handed over everything, emails, texts, gifts. She even testified that Nicole mentioned a life insurance policy, saying she would have money soon and could finally be free. Detectives now had motive, means, and timeline. But Nicole wasn't done lying. The insurance policy digging deeper, police found that Nicole had taken out a $400,000 life insurance policy on Becky in 2006, less than a year before the murder. It named Nicole as the sole beneficiary. It raised the most sinister question of all: was the affair a motivation, or just the cover? Was the real motive money, freedom funded by Becky's death, or was it both? Nicole was now at the center of one of the most shocking domestic murders in recent Illinois history: a same-sex love triangle, a staged disappearance, a woman betrayed and buried in her own trunk. Every lie Nicole told became evidence, every manipulation, a nail in her defense. And yet, through it all, she maintained her innocence, until the trial would force the truth into the light. Chapter 3. The night of March 15th. Villa Park, Illinois. Thursday, March 15th, 2007. It began like any ordinary day. Nicole Abusharif and Rebecca Klein had plans that evening. Nothing extravagant, just dinner and maybe a movie. They lived together, after all. These were routines. But under the surface, tension had been building for weeks. Becky had grown increasingly wary of Nicole's erratic schedule, her late nights, her mood swings. Her phone always turned screen down. That Thursday would be the last time anyone saw Becky alive. The final hour's surveillance from a nearby gas station later confirmed Becky was seen around 5:30 p.m., purchasing snacks and returning home. By all accounts, she was in a good mood. She'd spoken to co-workers earlier that day, made weekend plans, and texted a friend about a new TV series they wanted to start. Inside the house on Harvard Avenue, however, something shifted. Nicole had been acting distant. There were rumors Becky had confronted her about late nights, suspected cheating, and emotional withdrawal. She may not have known about Rose Sodaro specifically, but she sensed something wasn't right. The Mustang, parked carefully in the garage, sat still, waiting to become the scene of a concealed crime. A domestic betrayal. According to forensic experts and the state's eventual timeline, sometime between 6 and 9 p.m., an argument escalated into violence. Nicole, likely triggered by the confrontation and emotionally tangled in her double life, attacked Becky inside the home. There were no gunshots, no knives, no obvious signs of struggle. Nicole subdued her in silence. Investigators believe she blindfolded Becky with a bandana, tied her wrists and ankles with duct tape, and placed a plastic garbage bag over her head. The cause of death? Asphyxiation. What made it even more chilling was the deliberation. The materials weren't improvised. They were selected, prepared. Nicole had to have planned this, at least in part. There were no defensive wounds. Becky didn't fight back, which meant she may have trusted Nicole, even in her final moments. That trust was weaponized. The trunk. After Becky died, Nicole wrapped her in a blanket, possibly from their own bed, and carried her to the garage. She opened the trunk of the Mustang, the very car she had gifted Becky months earlier. The symbolism was inescapable, a gift turned coffin. She folded Becky's body into the trunk with disturbing precision. Then she locked it. The car remained parked in the garage, shielded from the cold Illinois night and from the suspicion of neighbors. She shut the garage door and turned off the lights. The murder was complete, but the performance had only just begun. Nicole's calm. What Nicole did next is what truly stunned investigators. She cleaned up, not just the crime scene, but herself. She changed clothes, gathered a bag, and drove to Rose Sodaro's dorm in Lyons Township, about 15 miles away. She walked in carrying a CD case and a change of clothes. To Rose, she appeared calm, affectionate, normal. They ordered food, watched movies, and talked about the future. Rose had no idea that just hours earlier, Nicole had killed the woman she lived with, and that same woman's body now lay hidden in the trunk of their shared Mustang. Later, Nicole would send Becky a text message. It read, "Where are you?" Becky's phone, lifeless in the trunk, would never respond. The message was meant to create a digital alibi. Nicole was trying to show concern, to make it seem as if she was searching for a missing partner, but to detectives, it was a clear sign of guilt. The pretense had begun. False leads and mixed signals. The following day, Friday, Nicole continued her act. She told a neighbor Becky had gone out drinking. She told a friend she might have left with another woman. She told Becky's co-workers that Becky was probably just blowing off steam. What she didn't tell anyone, that she had the only spare set of keys to the Mustang, that she had disabled Becky's phone, that she had accessed Becky's bank account using her debit card after the time of death. Investigators would later find surveillance footage of Nicole making a cash withdrawal from Becky's account while Becky lay dead just feet away in the garage. The deception was layered and intentional. Nicole wasn't just trying to escape justice. She was trying to erase Becky. The missing person report. On Saturday, March 17th, Becky's co-workers officially filed a missing person report. They told police this wasn't like her. She never missed work, never left without telling someone, never ignored her mother's calls. Villa Park police officers arrived at the house on Harvard Avenue and knocked. Nicole answered, subdued but cooperative. She claimed Becky had left Thursday night and never returned. When asked about the car, she said it hadn't moved in days. But one officer touched the Mustang's hood. It was warm. He made a mental note. The discovery. That evening, officers returned to the property. They had permission to search. This time, they focused on the garage. It was cold and dim, the single overhead light casting long shadows. The Mustang sat in silence, its surface clean, its doors locked. But when they opened the trunk, the air changed. A dense, sickly odor spilled out. Inside, wrapped in a blanket, was Becky Klein, her arms and legs bound, her face covered in duct tape and cloth, the bag still over her head. The horror of it was immediate. Becky hadn't been missing. She'd been here the whole time, confronting Nicole. When police broke the news to Nicole, she appeared to collapse. She wept. She said she couldn't believe it, but her story still didn't add up. She denied touching the duct tape, yet her fingerprints were found on both the tape and the plastic bag. She said she hadn't driven the car, but her DNA was all over the vehicle, and Becky had been dead long before Nicole claimed she last saw her. There were no signs of forced entry into the home, no robbery, no motive, unless you counted the $400,000 insurance policy. And then there was Rose. When detectives interviewed her, the timeline cracked wide open. Preparing for arrest, Nicole wasn't arrested immediately. Police wanted every detail in place, but they kept her close. They watched her behavior. They tracked her communication. She didn't flee. Maybe she thought she'd gotten away with it. Maybe she believed her lies would hold, but the walls were closing in. The forensics were undeniable, the digital trail damning, and the lies, dozens of them, were all about to collide in a courtroom. Chapter 4. Unraveling. Lies. Villa Park, Illinois. March 18, 2007. The discovery of Rebecca Klein's body in the trunk of her prized 1966 Mustang shattered any remaining illusion. But what followed was not just a typical murder investigation. It became a chilling dissection of deceit, of how one woman built an elaborate false identity, a fabricated romance, and a meticulously calculated narrative. Now, the mask was slipping, and the police weren't letting go. The interrogation begins. Nicole Abu Sharif was brought in for questioning that same night. She didn't ask for a lawyer. She looked exhausted. She slumped in her chair, claiming she was in shock. "I don't know what happened to her," she said. "I woke up, and she was just gone." But the detectives weren't buying it. One of them laid out photographs on the table. Becky's body in the trunk, the plastic bag, the duct tape, the bandana tied like a blindfold. Nicole's face shifted. "We found your fingerprints," the detective said.